and welcome to Food Stuff. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And, oh, it's finally here.
Yes.
Our bourbon episode.
Long awaited. Much anticipated, we hope.
Yeah, goodness.
It has been pretty often requested.
Yes.
And you and I certainly have built it up.
Just a little bit, yeah. We took that whole field trip thing, so...
Now I'm starting to wish we had, like, really lowered expectations.
Oh, yeah.
No, it's going to be good.
Okay.
It's going to be really good.
Well, if we ever figure out time travel, then we'll go back and do that.
We're going to start out with a disclaimer.
Oh, yes.
Drink responsibly, kids. Mm-hmm. Also, if alcohol is something you struggle with, definitely don't listen to this one, I would say.
Sure.
Because it's about bourbon and or American whiskey. Episodes on Irish whiskey and Scotch whiskey. Different. Forthcoming.
Oh, yes. And there's... You know, we do try to be relatively comprehensive here at How Stuff Works. Well, you know, we're still part of that here at Food Stuff. But I'm not going to say that this is the be-all, end-all, everything of bourbon. There's a lot of information out there about bourbon.
There really is. Did not let us down.
Yes. This is some of it.
Yes. And this is part one. This is our traditional Food Stuff breakdown. But we are going to have interviews because we went on a road trip to see bourbon country.
Uh-huh.
But in particular, because the great folks at Wild Turkey invited us up, and we took them up on that offer. Boy, did we.
Uh-huh.
And so there will be a follow-up interview from someone who has worked in this business. I was going to say a lot longer than us, but we haven't worked in it at all.
At all. So it's not untrue. But yes,
that is true.
Mr. Eddie Russell, who is the master distiller at Wild Turkey, sat down with us. And so we've got a whole other episode that's an interview with him. It's pretty okay. Just all right.
It's excellent. So let's start with our question we always start with.
Mm-hmm.
Bourbon. What is it?
Well, bourbon is a type of whiskey. Whiskey being a distilled alcohol made from a mash of grains like wheat, barley, corn, and rye. So what you do, you cook your grains with water. You ferment that mash using yeasts, which turn some of the sugars to alcohols, and that produces a distiller's beer that's about 9% alcohol or so. And then you distill that to create something much stronger. Distillation is basically a process where you heat a beer or wine to the point that the alcohol evaporates and can be collected separately from the water. Mm-hmm. Or the alcohol and alcohol-soluble stuff from the water and water-soluble stuff and any solids.
Any solids.
Any solids.
That you can imagine.
Yep. And depending on the types and amounts of grains that you use and the temperatures that you cook them at in order to release their sugars and the microorganisms that you use to ferment them, yeast poop!
Yay, once again.
Huh. And the exact process that you use to distill them and whether and how you age them, whiskeys can taste super different.
They really can, which is kind of a lovely thing about them.
It absolutely is.
They're versatile.
But bourbon more specifically.
Yes, bourbon is sometimes known by its Congress official designation of America's native spirit. Well, bourbon is a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
Here are the legal requirements you have to meet to call your product bourbon.
Mm-hmm.
The fermentation grain, a.k.a. mash, in bourbon must be at least 51% corn.
51 to 79% corn, I think. Anything more than that, and it's a corn whiskey.
Ah, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. A mix of wheat, barley, or rye usually makes up the rest.
That mix is called the mash bill.
Mm-hmm. It has to be aged in new charred oak barrels. I love that sentence, new charred oak barrels. We'll be talking more about that in a little bit.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Mm-hmm. When it enters those barrels, it needs to be 125 proof or lower. And when it leaves the barrels for bottles, it must be at least 80 proof. The only addition that can be made on the distilling end is water to achieve the proof you're looking for. No artificial colors or flavorings.
Not at all, no.
Mm-mm. On the consumer end, you can add all kinds of things. To be called straight bourbon, you have to age the bourbon at least 2 years. If the aging process is less than 4 years, you have to say that on the bottle. If a bottle doesn't have the age on it, it's at least 4 years old, and probably for your lower to middle of the road price point bottles, right around 4 years. Some folks argue that a true bourbon has to come from Kentucky, and 95% of the world's bourbon does come from Kentucky. Others say it just needs to be American made.
Which is the technical definition. But
right.
Yes, some people will indeed argue with you.
Oh, people love to argue about things like that. This is just something people disagree about. No real law saying it has to be from Kentucky. It could even be made from outside of the U.S. I know.
I just clutched my imaginary pearls.
She did. We both kind of sat back in our seats. I did read this somewhat obvious clarification, though. If it says Kentucky straight bourbon on the label, it has to be from Kentucky.
It's a good rule of thumb there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The barrels that bourbon is aged in do not actually have to be made from American oak, which is kind of a thing that gets floated around a lot. Mm-hmm. Any old charred oak will do, although American white oak is by far the most used because it grows here.
Makes sense.
Pretty plentifully. Bourbon can have lots of flavor notes, but essentially it's sweet and sort of spicy with notes of like vanilla and caramel and maybe baking spices with some savory undertones that are in the yeasty to bready sort of range. And you may have seen labels like high rye bourbon or less commonly prominent these days high wheat or wheated bourbon. And those labels aren't regulated down to like a particular percentage of rye or wheat in the mash bill, but they do indicate a higher than usual proportion of rye or wheat has gone into that bourbon. High ryes tend to be a little bit spicier on the palate. Think like Bullet or Basil Hayden. High wheats are softer and more baked goodsy. Think like Maker's Mark.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's also high corn bourbons, which are a little bit harder to come by and a little bit sweeter. Side note, American rye whiskey is not bourbon, but it is made in a similar way, just with instead of 51% corn, it has to be 51% rye in the mash bill.
Mm-hmm.
Canadian rye does not have a percentage requirement.
Ooh.
Yeah. Separate issue.
So many issues around this.
Side eye to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Canada.
Oh, Canada.
Sour mash bourbon, another label you may have seen, is a type of bourbon whiskey that uses some fermented mash from a previous batch in creating each new batch, sort of like a sourdough starter. And sour mashes tend to be a little bit sweeter and maybe more complex or sort of funky for that reason.
I think I've been described that way, complex and funky. Oh, I found a sticker that said that on my jacket once. I'm not lying.
I believe you entirely.
I don't know where it came from to this day.
I promise I didn't put it there.
I appreciated it.
Yeah.
I don't know how long it was there, but it's a badge of pride, so I'll take it.
Tennessee whiskey is also not bourbon, but it's whiskey that's made in Tennessee in the style of bourbon, except for the addition of one extra step. Before aging, it's filtered through charcoal in what's called the Lincoln County process. That charcoal is made from the wood of sugar maples. See our maple syrup episode for lots more about those. But anyway, the charcoal filters out some of the stuff and alcohol that you might not want.
Right there.
Some of the maybe harsher or spicier notes.
Mm-hmm.
Charcoal is especially good at removing sulfuric compounds. And so this creates a smoother, perhaps mellower product. And yeah, that's why Jack Daniel's is called a Tennessee whiskey, not a bourbon. It's filtered through those charcoal maple chips.
We did try to stop by there on our road trip up to bourbon country, but it was a little like just out of the way enough.
Yeah.
That we didn't go. But Jack Daniel's, if you're listening, we've proven we'll make the trip if the invite is extended.
Oh, goodness, yes. Get in touch.
Yes.
Foodstuff at howstuffworks.com. Drop us a note.
Yes, please.
Just wanted to clarify all of that stuff. But back to bourbon.
Yes. Typically, the darker the color, the higher the alcohol content. And of the 3.7 billion sales done annually, 2.7 billion of that is domestic. It is the most exported American spirit. In 2013, Americans consumed 24 million cases of U.S.-produced whiskey, which is a 30% increase from a decade earlier. 37% of these consumers were women, which I just like to point out because it has been kind of a stereotype that women don't drink whiskey.
Yeah, whiskey is a men's drink.
Yeah.
Bull.
Says, Lauren and I both love our whiskey.
We do indeed.
We do indeed.
It's true.
But it's growing in popularity, and especially, I don't want to say especially overseas, but like overseas as well, which is kind of a new market big deal.
Oh, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
It's becoming increasingly a very big deal, and we're going to get into some of the history of why and how that is happening. But first, we're going to get into a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. And this brings us to our particularly murky history bit. I feel like I say that all the time.
But this time she means it.
Yeah. It's fun, though.
It is. A lot of the history of whiskey is kind of the stuff of legend, and it's the type of product that people like sort of pontificating about, I think. So.
Yes. Lots of people want to take credit for this one.
Oh, yeah.
For sure. Now, American whiskey obviously descended from Irish and Scottish whiskey, which both have a long history going back to European monks in medieval times. But American whiskey,
bourbon,
is its own obviously younger thing. And that's what we're focusing on today.
Mm-hmm.
Friendly history disclaimer of the podcast. Before American whiskey became what we know it as today, it was unaged, and I imagine quite strong. Written records indicate that the first grain distillery in America occurred in 1713. The colonists used whiskey as liquid courage during the Revolutionary War and when venturing west. And not kidding about that liquid courage thing, George Washington proposed that public distilleries be constructed in states, colonies at the time, where Revolutionary War battles were going down, and said, quote, "The benefits arising from the moderate use of strong liquor have been experienced in all armies and are not to be disputed."
He was a distiller himself, so I feel like he had a little bit of a personal stake in the matter.
Could be. Speaking of moving west, to persuade people to settle in the land that would become Kentucky, settlers who built cabins and planted corn in that area were offered 400 acres to do so as part of the 1776 Virginia Corn Patch and Cabin Rights Act. That's a fun act name.
Uh-huh.
Kentucky was a part of Virginia at the time, and this offer attracted a lot of immigrants from Scotland and Ireland. And these immigrants were looking to distill some whiskey. And lucky for those wannabe distillers, Kentucky happens to be over blue limestone, as we mentioned in our
Derby episode.
Yes, thank you. Blue limestone is a great thing for filtering out iron and replacing it with calcium, which imparts its grains, and eventually whiskey, with a sweeter, less harsh flavor. Another thing that would end up coming in handy when it comes to bourbon making in Kentucky is the dramatic shifts in temperature. This is conducive for the whiskey to move in and out of barrels, which is a large part of the flavor and the color. As you might surmise, Kentucky soil is great for growing corn, and since it was the predominant grain in the area, distillers decided to use that instead of rye. The Samuels, the family behind Maker's Mark, claim that they got started making bourbon in 1783. However, they didn't start selling it until 1840. Still possible. Well, the man behind the secret family recipe, T.W. Samuels, set up a distillery and the family bourbon got its start. In 1943, the family recipe was burned by someone in the family.
Ooh, intrigue.
I know. Then retooled to be less bitter, resulting in the Maker's Mark we know today.
Ah.
All is well, question mark?
I think they're doing okay for themselves, so.
I would agree with that statement. Whether or not the Samuels family story truly got its start in 1783, the first commercial distillery opened in Louisville, Kentucky. You might recognize the name because it still graces a lot of whiskey bottles. Evan Williams.
So, speaking of names.
Yes.
Annie, how did bourbon get its name?
Well, let me tell you, Lauren, if I may. In 1785, Bourbon County, Kentucky was established. This area encompassed 14 modern counties, not the same today. The county was named after a French royal family that we've mentioned before, House of Bourbon, in honor of France's help during the Revolutionary War.
Or,
that's one theory. It wouldn't be where did the name come from if there wasn't multiple theories. Another theory is that it has to do with two brothers from France that settled in Louisville, Kentucky. According to this theory, it was them that got the idea to send whiskey and charred barrels down the river to Louisiana. And it's because they knew the French population there would enjoy its similarity to cognac,
ah,
a.k.a. French brandy. By that time, Bourbon Street already had established itself as the place to be in New Orleans. So people started looking for the, quote, whiskey they sell on Bourbon Street. Two prevailing theories. You decide. We're going to let you make up your own mind, listeners.
Absolutely.
Another story about who maybe invented bourbon that we ran into a lot was the one of Elijah Craig. Craig was a Baptist minister who came up with aging corn whiskey in charred barrels in 1789, which was the same year he opened a distillery. However, supporting evidence for this tale is hard to come by, and there were corn whiskey distilleries in the area before 1789, so more than one distiller may have come up with this idea, but he does often get the credit. The story goes that after experimentation, Craig decided the quickest way to clean out a fish barrel before putting bourbon in it was to burn and char the inside. You know, he's being thrifty. He stamped the barrel with its county of origin, bourbon, and sent it down the river to Louisiana. When it arrived 90 days later, the flavor had evolved to become much smoother. People in New Orleans who sampled it often asked for more whiskey from bourbon. And one of the reasons Elijah Craig's story as the inventor of bourbon may have proliferated is due to the fact that he was a Baptist preacher and his name was used to combat all the pro-prohibition folks.
Ah.
Yeah. Although he had been found guilty of producing whiskey without a license.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. I think some other people say he didn't invent bourbon, but he invented charring of the barrel, and that is part of what we define as bourbon now.
Absolutely.
So maybe that's another reason that he's often pointed to as the inventor. But now, let's talk about the Whiskey Rebellion.
Oh, this is a good one.
Yeah.
it's an intense one.
It really is. Okay. So here's what went down. The year was 1791. The president, one George Washington, in order to help pay down the federal deficit, an excise tax was levied on whiskey and other distilled spirits. Whiskey in particular had surpassed rum as the U.S.'s most popular liquor after the Revolutionary War and the triangle trade with Britain decreased rum imports. As you're probably aware, Americans don't like taxes to begin with, and particularly not on their whiskey. You may know that from a little musical called Hamilton.
Never heard of it.
You should really check it out. It's playing at the Fox right now. And this tax was particularly disliked among distillers in Maryland and Pennsylvania. They grew a lot of rye and made rye-based whiskey for the export. People refused to pay the tax, and an excise officer in Pennsylvania was tarred and feathered. And a crowd of 6,000 gathered to protest. Allegedly, one protester was loudly calling for the guillotine.
Wow.
For the excise
tax
officer.
Collector. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whew.
Yeah, and one thing to note here, a lot of trade was done by barter at the time, so a lot of folks didn't have cash. Wealthy Pennsylvania landowner John Neville agreed to collect the taxes in western Pennsylvania. Silly, silly John Neville. When an angry mob gathered outside his house one night, he shot into the crowd, killing a man, and things escalated from there. The mob started shooting at Neville. Neville sounded his early version of a home alarm, and his slaves started shooting at the mob, forcing them all to eventually flee. It wasn't over, however. The very next evening, 700 men converged on Neville's home, only to find he had wisely fled, leaving behind 10 soldiers to defend it. The mob set the barn and slave dwellings on fire and began shooting at the soldiers. An hour of gunfighting ensued, leading to the death of the mob's leader. Furious, the mob set fire to the main house, and the soldiers surrendered.
Oh.
The mob's new leader discovered that Pittsburgh was trying to distance itself from the attack on Neville's home, and he used this info to convince his followers, 7,000 of them, that they needed to attack Pittsburgh. A Pittsburgh delegation responded with a peace offering of whiskey, which the mob enjoyed, and then was too drunk to follow through on their plan of attack.
Well played, Pittsburgh.
I mean, yeah. At first, Washington tried to find a peaceful resolution, but when that didn't work, he put on his general's uniform, labeled their actions as treasonable opposition, and showed up in Pennsylvania with 12,000 troops. Thus, in 1704, the Whiskey Rebellion came to an end. This was one of America's first tests of the federal government. All about whiskey and taxes. Actually makes perfect sense to me.
It really does.
The tax was repealed when Thomas Jefferson was in office in 1802. Thanks to this whole affair, the U.S. government was hesitant to tax whiskey, doing so briefly to cover the cost of the War of 1812 and eventually the Civil War, choosing instead to tax rum.
They've reneged on that since then.
Oh, absolutely they have.
Yeah.
There's a popular myth that the whiskey tax and rebellion led to a lot of tax-dodging distillers to make the move to Kentucky, but this probably isn't true. Fun, but not true, I would guess. At the time of the rebellion, there were already 500 distilleries operating in the state. George Washington didn't seem too bitter about the whole thing, though. Looking to make some cash after his presidency was over, he heeded the advice of his Scottish plantation manager and financed a distillery. By the end of 1797, he had 5 copper stills. He was making rye whiskey, which he offered for 50 cents on the gallon. His distillery was producing 11,000 gallons a year by 1799.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I wonder if he used it to make his signature eggnog.
Oh. Oh, yes. I hope so.
I do, too. We have someone in our office who makes George Washington's recipe of signature eggnog every year.
Yeah, Producer Alex, right?
Yeah, Producer Alex. It's delightful.
It is delightful.
It's very boozy.
It's not boozy.
Yes. We can only hope. Mysteries of history. Anywho, the distillery burned down in 1814, but was restored and turned into a distillery museum in 2007. I would love to see pictures, if any listeners have been.
Yeah.
Yeah. In 1795, Jacob Beam sold his first barrel of whiskey.
That Beam?
Yes, that Beam. Old Jacob Bean Sour. I keep saying Bean. It's Beam.
Beam.
Since then, it's been passed down in the family, including Jim Bean. That's where the name comes from. Also one I really wanted to go to, and again, it was a little kind of...
A little too far out of the way.
Yeah.
We were on a tight schedule.
We were, but we hope to return one day.
Yeah.
We have our eyes set.
We have more donuts to try.
Free t-shirts.
Oh.
To earn.
Yes.
As rum grew more expensive, whiskey grew more popular. Since Kentucky was located near several rivers and slavery was legal in the state's bourbon industry grew too, able to move their bourbon easily and produce it relatively cheaply. By the 1820s, the word bourbon, in terms of American whiskey, first started appearing in ads. The Pepper Distillery developed the sour mash in 1823. The Pepper Distillery would later become the Woodford Reserve. The man behind this development was a Scottish doctor named James Crow. The whiskeys he produced were really popular during the Civil War, and he is sometimes credited with inventing bourbon because he knew what methods to use to produce consistently good bourbon, and he knew why it worked. On top of that, he used charred cask, and he used corn, he aged it, and sour mash thing. So he was certainly closing in on what
we consider bourbon to be today.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Bourbon officially becomes bourbon in 1840. Yay, bourbon! Around this time, a process known as rectifying whiskey was fairly common. That's where wholesalers would mix whiskeys from a handful of distilleries to arrive at a new, consistent product they would call their own. Most of them were on the up and up, but a few would mix a tiny bit of bourbon or whiskey with large amounts of neutral grain spirits.
Ooh.
And add in some flavorings. But they would still call it straight whiskey. A recipe for it was even published in 1860, and that same year, Americans were drinking 28% more liquor than they had been 10 years earlier. At the same time, temperance movements were popping up in both Europe and the U.S. Some states banned alcohol long before Prohibition. One organization promoting moderation in alcohol consumption in New York had 2 sorts of membership levels. Either you could swear off the liquor, but enjoy as much beer and wine as you'd like, or you could swear off everything in what was called total abstinence. Members that chose from that got a T next to their name, and that's where teetotaler comes from. Maybe.
Probably.
Probably, I would say. But you know. The outbreak of the Civil War, also in 1860, led to a whiskey shortage. It was used medicinally, poured over wounds as a painkiller. And also soldiers just drank it to forget for a bit all the destruction, violence, or for that liquid courage that Washington described.
Sure.
One account I read claimed that a regiment of Union soldiers made a batch of their own whiskey for Christmas 1864. The Sons of Temperance blamed some of the Union's losses on drinking, probably whiskey, to which President Lincoln's secretary John Hay responded, quote, "The rebels drink more and worse whiskey than we do." The Confederacy, which was lacking in food, declared prohibition on a state-by-state basis, buying as much whiskey as they could find for medicinal purposes. This was rather loosely obeyed. Some whiskey-loving colonels just made it themselves. A black market for whiskey arose, and whiskey went from about 25 cents to $35 a gallon.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Once the war ended, a handful more distilleries opened in Kentucky that you may recognize. The Stagg Distillery in 1866-ish. The Rippey Family Distillery that would become Wild Turkey in 1869. And Stitzel Distillery, Stitzel Weller Distillery, home of Old Rip Van Winkle Bourbon in 1872. Old Rip Van Winkle Bourbon would be resurrected, and you can buy it if you've got the money to this day. It's really expensive, like thousands of dollars expensive.
Yes.
I think we took some pictures of some that we saw. Just a picture.
Yeah, or possibly the bottles. Like, there were a couple bottles of it, or empty bottles of it, rather, in the Airbnb that we were staying in as decoration.
Yes. Yeah. And producer Ramsey kept jokingly texting us while he knew we were in Kentucky, asking us to bring him back a bottle of this.
The only thing I want is just a bottle of Pappy's. It was around this time, post-Civil War and in the midst of the Industrial Revolution, that distilling started becoming a large-scale operation. Smaller numbers of larger producers were working in the field, saving on costs with all of this newfangled machinery and also very newfangled production concepts, assembly line kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And those names that we still know today were innovators in that sector for sure.
Mm-hmm. And something I found kind of cool, kind of weird, throughout bourbon's history, there was this interesting connection with prostitution. One of the reasons behind this connection is police didn't search cars if a woman was present. Ooh, that would be rude.
Oh, sure.
So even if they themselves weren't doing the bootlegging, bootleggers wanted women around, and prostitutes could legally sell alcohol and weed.
Ah.
In 1850s New York City, women made $2 million selling whiskey and $3 million in sex work. So
it's pretty even.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
In 1870, there was a whiskey scheme, a spirited plot.
Spirited.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Thank you. An investigation conducted in 1874 revealed that the government agents tasked with keeping track of how much whiskey was being made in the U.S. had been accepting the cash equivalent to about half of what a distillery would pay in taxes in exchange for looking the other way on a certain percentage of the distillate.
Oh.
Yeah. This group of agents were a part of something called the Whiskey Ring. Ooh. When tax collectors not in the ring showed up, distillery owners were told to fork over the cash and, quote, play safe. The distillers were told the money that they were paying the agents was going into a fund to reelect the president at the time, President Grant. This scheme, Whiskey Gate, if you will, amounted to an annual 15 million gallons of whiskey, which would have netted about $7.5 million in taxes during the 4 years before the whiskey ring was uncovered.
Whoa.
Yeah. Over 300 people were arrested, and it turned into a whole fiasco for Grant, who had friends implicated and therefore kind of guilty by association.
Yeah.
The investigation also revealed that Grant was probably having an extramarital affair. Bad day for him.
Ugh.
Then one of his friends that had been arrested claimed Grant was involved in the whole thing. He was not reelected. Different times. I almost didn't include this because it was complicated tax stuff, but it was too good to leave out.
Yeah. Well, I think that also there's enough complicated tax stuff involved in whiskey that it's part and parcel.
Really is. And throwback to our catch-up episode, remember Dr. Wiley and all that concern about preservatives and dyes and the push for food standards?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We briefly mentioned it in that episode, but one of the ways Dr. Wiley convinced President Roosevelt to go along with increased food safety regulation was by presenting him with a bottle of bad whiskey. Roosevelt was like, by God, not the whiskey! We must fix this, and now! I hope that's what he sounded like. And this brings us to Prohibition.
Oh.
Yeah. It was an amendment to the U.S. Constitution, the 18th one to be exact, basically prohibiting alcohol in the U.S. that went to effect in 1920. It was very not good for the bourbon industry. It almost went completely under. A lot of distilleries never reopened after this. 10 distilleries were given permission by the U.S. government to manufacture medicinal whiskey, including Woodford Reserve and Stitzel Weller Distillery. And women played an instrumental role keeping bourbon and American whiskey alive during Prohibition. Like we said, police wouldn't search cars if women were in them. Seems like a pretty big flaw in the whole system. But in this case, it helped them smuggle whole cases of liquor. Some of these women made millions of dollars. At the height of bootlegging, women had men beat 5-1 when it came to sales. One famous example is that of Gertrude Lithgow, whose nicknames included Grace and Cleo. Cleopatra, Queen of Bootlegging, to be specific. While she was working for a London liquor exporter in New York, when either she or her boss got the idea to get into the bootlegging business, in her words, fortunes were being made during Prohibition, and she wanted in on it. In 1923, she sold 2 million gallons of rye whiskey. And this is in the face of sexism. People didn't want to buy from her. They thought she, like, had no idea what she was talking about. Some clubs at the time had no skirt laws. And in some places, including a lot of distilleries, women weren't allowed to wear pants. So you can't come in because you're in a skirt.
Yeah.
Yeah. During this time, it wasn't socially acceptable for women to drink liquor either. So a lot of people were quite suspicious of her motives. There were all kinds of rumors about her being a spy or an employee of the U.S. government. She had quite the reputation. She had fans. She was followed by paparazzi. Wow. And eventually arrested and later released free of charges. There's a whole book about this thing, more stories than Cleo's, but it's called Whiskey Women, The Untold Story of How Women Saved Bourbon, Scotch, and Irish Whiskey by Fred Minnick, if you would like to seek it out. When Prohibition ended in 1930, bourbon distilleries had lost a lot of ground. They had to restock, and they were competing with Canadian and Irish whiskeys, which had both the lighter stuff that Americans had come to prefer and the stronger stuff already on hand for people who didn't prefer the lighter stuff. In a lot of cases, bourbon had to start from scratch. Four Roses was the most popular post-Prohibition bourbon, in part because of a successful holiday marketing campaign tying it to holiday celebrations, or as an easy gift idea. I still see this every year.
Yeah.
The distillery, yeah, they ran it every year, and so it got in people's heads that, oh, you know what? Maybe I will give so-and-so a bottle of Four Roses. Seeing this success, other distilleries followed suit. Jim Beam even had a holiday ad in 1960 with Sean Connery.
Oh. Very distinguished.
Very. The law requiring bourbon to go in new barrels passed in the mid-1930s, pushed by a representative from Arkansas. The wood from those barrels was largely from Arkansas at the time, and in his words, you'll use more wood if you only use it once.
The timber lobby was a major force to be reckoned with in the early to mid-1900s, and through the Great Depression and beyond, it garnered really impressive tax breaks and other legislation to increase jobs and revenue in that market. There is good scientific reason to use new barrels for every batch of bourbon, but the timber lobby certainly helped.
Yes.
And although it might sound wasteful, it's really not. Those barrels are reused for all sorts of things. Lots of craft beers are now aged in bourbon barrels, and apparently some 97% of Scotch whiskies are now aged in bourbon barrels. American bourbon barreling laws have apparently changed the timber of Scotch significantly from what it was like prior to the 20th century, prior to this law going into effect, wherein it was aged in European oak, wine, or sherry casks.
Yeah.
Up until then. So who knew?
That definitely came up. I did a Scotch whiskey tour when I was in Scotland, and I do remember that coming up. And
I love it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean the story, but also Scotch, both.
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 Me as well.
Yeah.
In 1958, the Bourbon Institute was founded. Their goal was to promote the heck out of bourbon. And I'd say their efforts were successful, too. By 1962, bourbon was the highest-selling spirit in America. Sales tripled from the Institute's inception in 1958 to 1970, and Congress made the whole America's Native Spirit thing official. Alas, Sean Connery! But this time in the form of James Bond.
Ugh.
He put an end to all of that.
Traitor.
I know. With his preference for vodka drinks.
How quickly the tables turn.
Sean Connery. In 1973, vodka surpassed bourbon as America's most consumed spirit. To be fair to James Bond, he doesn't deserve all the blame, not all. We can also blame all the young ladies.
Ladies.
Yep. That's right. As more women started drinking, the demand for a lighter liquor like vodka increased. the beginning of the stereotype, perhaps? Or did women order vodka because of the stereotype? Or did they just like vodka? Could be any of those things, all of those things. I actually think I've read in multiple places that women did see it as more socially acceptable to order clear, quote, lighter liquor because they weren't really supposed to be drinking it.
Right. So, like, this could just be a soda water.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And speaking of James Bond, listener Amy wrote in when she got wind we were doing this episode and asked if we were going to touch on Kingsman 2, The Golden Circle. And disclaimer, I haven't seen it, but I knew immediately why she asked. Before the movie came out, I was wandering around New York Comic Con dressed as Winter Soldier for work, as you do. And I walked past this very regal-looking bar pop-up where you could sample Statesman Bourbon, which is a spin-off by Old Forester created for the movie.
What?
Which you can now buy in stores. And you could buy it several months before the movie came out. In the film, an opening scene revolves around the discovery of a bottle of this stuff in a safe, and characters drink it throughout the film.
What?
Yeah, and the master taster describes the flavor as character rich.
Oh.
Well played. This has been pointed to as an interesting example of marketing.
Yeah, that's like Willy Wonka level.
Yeah, it really is.
That's great.
Yeah, that's what it made me think of.
Or horrifying in a certain way. I don't know. It's interesting.
I do know that a lot of people, professional whiskey connoisseurs who reviewed it were like, you know, it's not my thing, but I do appreciate that they really put like time and effort. It wasn't like a cheap,
yeah,
you know.
It wasn't like bourbon flavored or something,
yeah,
like that.
Yeah,
like they made a bourbon.
Yeah, exactly.
There would be a serious resurgence in whiskeys of all kinds, starting slowly in the opulent 1980s, with increased consumer demand for high quality and kind of conspicuous consumption liquors.
Uh-huh.
When the craft cocktail boom began in the early 2000s, a wide range of whiskeys found new old homes in classic cocktails like the Manhattan and the Old Fashioned. Bourbon is pretty great in those. Simultaneously, state regulations on distilleries were being loosened, making it more possible for small businesses to start the long process of creating bourbons. By 2013, sales of bourbon and Tennessee whiskey in the United States were up almost 13% year over year. And as we suggested earlier, American whiskeys were 68% of the export market in terms of cash value, worth then a little under $1 billion.
Ooh.
That's these days it's up to about a billion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Huge international brands have been buying up bourbon companies that have been owned and operated by American families for decades. And those companies are investing millions of dollars on increased production. The master distillers and local owners have become celebrities. It's a wild culture.
It really is.
The bourbon resurgence, though, has put stress on the barrel-making industry.
Oh, interesting.
Here in America, because there are plenty of white oaks around, or sometimes less in some of the areas that they've traditionally been farmed or harvested from because of settlement, because of new population growth.
Right.
But the recent recession made logging less profitable, so there are fewer workers in the logging industry to harvest the wood. And a couple of rainy seasons have made things a little bit difficult. It's difficult for barrel-making times.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so increased demand for bourbon plus decreased actual production of barrels,
yeah,
has seen distilleries basically entering bidding wars to get barrels from these coopers. Yeah, like offering like 100% markup on what they are selling their barrels for.
Oh, man. I wonder if we would ever reach a point where that law is...
Oh, gets repealed because of a lack of barrel?
Yeah, or maybe there's like a two-tiered... Like maybe you have to both specify how old it is and...
What kind of barreling process. Yeah.
Huh.
It is really integral to the taste of bourbon.
Yes.
And we are going to get into that. But first, we're going to get into one more quick break for a word from our sponsor.
Back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you. So, all right. If you're talking about the flavor involved in bourbon, there is a serious science as much as an art to that.
Mm-hmm.
There was this team of researchers back in 2013 who were looking into the chemical profile of American whiskeys, and they presented their findings at this meeting of the American Chemical Society. The team of researchers is led by a guy named Tom Collins. And you cannot make this up.
Nope. Nope, you can't.
It's I'm almost as fond of that as I am of Dr. Fowler, the chicken scientist. But what they found, across 60 whiskeys that they investigated, some 4,000 non-volatile compounds, the ones that don't tend to evaporate off. Any given whiskey contained hundreds of these flavor compounds. They eventually identified some 50 to 100 tannins, fatty acids, and alcohols that make up a bourbon spirit's spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that some compounds were characteristic of particular types of American whiskey, bourbon versus rye versus Tennessee whiskey, etc. But they also found that sometimes what distillery a whiskey came from mattered more than what was actually in its mash bill. They called this a distillery fingerprint, which I imagine must be an artifact of the fermentation yeast cultures and the handling during aging that brings out different and specific qualities.
I love that.
The actual yeasts that make up those fermented cultures are proprietary. They can be patented here in the United States, and they are closely guarded.
Oh, yes.
Wild Turkey's, for example, is from 1954. Jim Beam's is supposedly from 1933, caught wild on James Beam's back porch after Prohibition ended.
I love this image of just someone with a net. Got you.
Maker's Mark says that they've got the same one they were using in the 1860s. As we covered in our sour beer episode, different species and subspecies and particular strains of yeasts and bacteria produce very different flavor compounds in alcohol. And some distilleries, like Four Roses, will actually label their single-barrel bourbons with a code that can tell you which of their yeast cultures they used for that batch so that you can kind of compare and contrast.
Oh, that's so fun.
Yeah. And, okay, here's where we're going to get into all of that barrel stuff.
Yes.
Because wood is crazy, y'all. It's all right. As we dipped into in our maple syrup episode, trees' lifeblood is sap, a watery, sugary stuff that's full of various compounds that trees use for nutrition, self-defense against infection by insects and microbes, you know, healing powers, all that tree kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The exact components in a given piece of wood from a given tree vary, of course, by the tree's species, but also by the latitude and climate where the tree grew, the age and size it was when it was harvested, the season it was harvested in, the part of the tree, upper or lower, where the wood comes from. It's a living thing.
Yeah.
And it varies intensely. And like any living thing, wood is made up of cells that are semi-permeable. All those compounds in the wood can cross in or out given the right conditions. Of course, you don't want the wood of a barrel to be too permeable. I mean, you want it to be watertight or liquor tight, as the
sure.
case may be. So as full of stuff as wood is, coopers, barrel makers, are going to do a few things that bring even more potential flavor compounds to the party in order to make that watertight thing
uh-huh.
happen. Okay. First,
okay.
The raw wood must be seasoned or dried. This reduces the amount of water in the wood, which is what drying usually does,
mm-hmm.
Which is important because it shrinks the wood down into a kind of evenly denser, more compact package. This is the same thing that's done for firewood. If you used raw wood for barrels, that drying would happen over time anyway, but unevenly, and it could warp and crack. No bueno.
Mm-mm.
The traditional method for seasoning wood is outdoors, slowly, in the open air, over the course of a dry season.
Oh.
Which exposes the wood to all kinds of free-range bacteria and yeasts, which eat some of the sugars in the wood and start producing some of your flavor compounds and or precursors to flavor compounds. Heckin' bacteria poop, y'all!
We need, like, I want a 20-foot by 20-foot... artist rendition of bacteria poop. If anyone out there is looking to add something to their portfolio,
yeah,
just saying.
I'm not sure what that like mural would look like, but I want it.
Yeah. I want to know.
Okay, so once the wood is seasoned, it can be made into barrels or into staves for barrels, which are the sections of a barrel.
Right.
Yeah. To do this, the cooper is going to heat the staves, the planks, so that they bend. And in this process, they're also toasting the wood. Think of the way that toasting a piece of bread changes the flavors. The heat breaks down some of the molecular structures in the wood, making some potential flavor compounds available and creating some flavor compounds from the stuff that's already there. The fancy science term for this being pyrolysis. And I'm pretty sure that all wood barrels are at least a wee bit toasted from this heating process, but for bourbon barrels, they are also charred. And this is where the cooper actually burns the inside of the barrel. If you took a cross-section, at least like an eighth of an inch of it would just be black. And it's about 3 millimeters for all of our more sensible metric cousins out there.
Yep.
And charring does a couple of things. First, you're building a charcoal filter into the barrel. As we mentioned way at the top of this episode, billions of years ago,
yep.
charcoal filters some of the harsh flavor compounds out of whiskey. So that's cool. You're also creating a different set of flavors because as wood goes from a light toast to a full char, you're moving from like vanilla and caramel and clove flavors through nuts and cedar and honey to like coffee and ginger and smoke. And depending on your charring technique and how long you keep the whiskey in there, the whiskey can access a little bit of all of that as it ages.
Mm-hmm.
Barrels are so important to the flavor of finished bourbon. Good white whiskey, which is the colorless distillate that goes into barrels and becomes bourbon as it ages and draws out compounds from the wood, white whiskey will have flavors of corn and rye and barley, whatever else is going into your mash, but none of the spices are vanillas. Back in 2013, one Wayne Curtis was writing a piece for The Atlantic and asked some dozen industry folks about how much of a difference the barrel makes in their bourbon's flavor. And they said they responded anywhere from 50 to 80% of their bourbon is just barrel.
That's fascinating.
Huh.
Yeah. Over half.
The construction technology involved in the warehouses that store bourbon is also really serious stuff. Traditionally, they have these thick stone walls that act as insulators against the extremes of heat and cold. Tin roofs, rusted, which, being reflective, help the building absorb less heat energy from the sun. The bottom floor would be built over a bare dirt crawl space, meaning that a little bit of ground moisture can get in under there, keeping the building humidified. And that humidity, plus ventilation from parallel windows throughout the building and stacking the barrels such that heat can move up through the building, means that you're further moderating the temperature in there, mm-hmm. keeping it warm in the winter, cool in the summer, relatively.
Uh-huh.
Relatively because you do want some differences in temperature, as Annie said earlier, because that's going to be what causes the wood of the barrels to interact with the alcohol inside of them. Okay, when the contents of a barrel warm up, they're going to expand slightly, thus increasing the pressure inside the barrel. The barrel holds tight, so this pressure forces some of the alcohol that's expanding into the grain of the wood. The carbon layer from that char filters some stuff out, and the alcohol, being a solvent, breaks down some of the microstructures in the wood, releasing and changing the compounds there. When the temperature cools down again, that liquid contracts back out of the wood. This happens both on a small scale every day and night, and on a larger scale throughout the seasons every year.
So much science happening.
I know! Ugh! I got like kind of verklempt during this again, like, which I needs to be on our bingo card anyway. Lauren gets emotional. Some distilleries will actually game this system by purposefully letting their barrels get overly hot in the summer and overly cold in the winter, thus increasing the rate at which the bourbon draws compounds out of the wood, and thus decreasing the amount of time that it takes to age the bourbon to a palatable level of bourbonosity.
Bourbonosity. I think that's how it's pronounced.
I think, yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. Thank you. you can also use smaller barrels, thus increasing the ratio of barrel surface to liquor and getting more liquor to filter through the wood faster. Another factor that comes in during aging, and one that is harder to rush, is oxidation. Because although barrels are watertight, they are not totally airtight. As oxygen molecules interact with the compounds in the whiskey over time, they'll break some of them down, leaving new chemicals that will interact with the wood in new ways, creating new different flavor compounds. This is why younger bourbons will tend to taste a little bit greener or like cornier, really.
Oh, there's a joke there.
There absolutely is. I'll write in and let us know. And older bourbons will have sort of richer flavors. All of this has been worked out via trial and error over the past few hundred years. And, bourbon makers go in and taste the product that's aging in different barrels in different parts of a warehouse. They find the ones that they like, and they try to figure out how to create more of those conditions across more of their stock. And it can be really trial-y and really error-y. There's a distillery in the Hudson Valley that plays loud music in its warehouses to literally shake its whiskey up, hoping to increase the interactions between the liquor and the wood. There was one time that a tornado hit the Buffalo Trace Distillery in Kentucky and took off the roof and one wall of one of their warehouses, exposing 25,000 barrels inside to the elements for months while they were repairing the building. 5 years later, that stuff was delicious. And no one had any idea why. They labeled it tornado surviving bourbon. And customers loved it. I mean, not only because of the, I mean, I would buy something called tornado surviving bourbon. But
I absolutely would too.
But it was really tasty, apparently.
I love that. That's so cool. Like, why?
Lots of factors.
It really is kind of trial and error and just hands off. All right.
Just like, well.
Do your thing.
I'll check you back in with you in a year or two.
Maybe I'll play some loud music and maybe you'll dig that.
Is it a stick sort of day? What do you guys think? I don't know.
It's definitely 80s, like...
like hair metal?
Yeah, I think so.
I certainly hope so.
We clearly should make our own bourbon.
Oh, no, don't suggest that. That's a lot of homework, Annie.
Well, we have, 6 years before we'll... It's a while.
That's true. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's work on it.
Although, well... I guess you test it, but how depressing would it be? Wait, that 6 years. It's gross.
Oh. There's a lot of science that has been laid out before us that would help us on our way.
Absolutely. So this is our bourbon episode. There was so much.
Yeah, this didn't really get into the distillation process itself. I think we went into that a little bit in our gin episode?
Yeah.
Gin and tonic? Yeah. But I'd like to get into more of that at a later time and date when we do another whiskey episode.
And again, we're going to have a follow-up.
Right.
So this was sort of part of our foodstuff road trip to Kentucky.
Absolutely. Yes. Coming back to you with the audio from our tour of the Wild Turkey facility and our interview with Eddie Russell.
Yes. But in the meantime.
Mm-hmm.
Listener mail. Samantha wrote, I was listening to the pasta episode today, and while I was already hooked, since pasta's kind of my favorite thing, the listener mail regarding the garbage plate caught my ear. If you guys ever come to Illinois, be sure to come to Springfield. Done. We have more besides Abraham Lincoln. There is a local dish here called a horseshoe. It's Texas toast topped with meat, usually a hamburger patty, then topped with french fries, and then finally the whole thing is smothered in a cheese sauce. It's delicious and horrible for you all at the same time. You may be wondering why it's called a horseshoe. Yep. There are many different stories surrounding the name origin, although none have been confirmed. My husband's theory is that the toast represents the horse handler's hand, the patty the hoof, and the fries are the nails. I don't remember his reasoning for the cheese. Who needs reasoning for cheese? Annie aside, off the top of my head. I'm guessing it's because it's delicious and ties the whole thing together. You're probably right, Samantha.
As cheese does for many things.
Yeah. Oh, it so does. It is the rug in the room that you need. Also, I want to thank everybody who wrote in and said that they also eat their pasta separately.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Goodness. It was very heartening.
I know. I was like, oh, something inside me eased. And also, a lot of people wrote in that, like our super producer Dylan, they eat Cheetos with chopsticks. Yeah. Yeah. It must be like a Cheeto aficionado thing.
Yeah. You know, you've got to eat the Cheetos and you don't want to get messy.
It's very practical.
Yeah.
And you just look cool.
You do.
People are like,
Certified. Yes. People will stop and ask you, hey, what are you doing?
Yeah. It's like that Seinfeld episode where somebody's cutting up the the candy bar, and then everyone starts doing it because they think it's really fancy and like a trend.
Right.
Yeah. So could be a whole Cheeto trend.
Except this is fancy and a trend.
You heard it here on Food Stuff.
You did.
Mm-hmm.
Taylor wrote, I really enjoyed your recent episode on maple syrup. Thank you. I grew up in a small Canadian town where we have a large maple syrup festival every year. Several years ago, my then-boyfriend, now husband, and I were traveling in Europe and brought several 100-milliliter bottles of Ontario syrup for our hosts. Apparently, we were over the liquid limit when flying out of Ireland. Instead of letting the real Canadian syrup just get thrown out by the Irish TSA, I opened a bottle and drank it in the security line. I was hopped up on sugar for the next several hours, but it was worth it.
Taylor, you're a hero. I would have been so impressed.
That is beautiful. Also, Taylor says, in response to a recent listener mail about the French-Canadian pineapple, ananas, I think most of us were trying to scrub it from our memory.
It was quite unsettling.
It was scrubbable. It was, yep. Can't say I blame you.
No. So thanks to both of them so much for writing in. You too can write to us. Our email is foodstuff@howstuffworks.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter @foodstuffhsw and on Instagram @foodstuff. We hope to hear from you. Thank you to our super producer, Dylan Fagan, who went with us on this entire bourbon journey.
He's clearly a trendsetter.
Yeah, although he does not like bourbon himself.
No, but it was a delight to have someone around who could drive you.
And who would give us his drink tokens.
Yes.
Also, he's just generally a delight to have around. Yes. I want to emphasize that point. Thank you to you for listening. And we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.